Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and we're told all over the world accessing the show on the internet. The theme of this week's show is community. Brian Grist is here to talk about an old friend and local musician for many years, Mr. John Loder. Tom Stubbs from Somerset-based Bigger House Films works with people with dementia, people with learning difficulties, travellers and other interesting people in the Southwest. Katie Williams and Aaron Penman are two third-year graphic designers from UWE who are working on a project called Community, which aims to bring people together by giving them a free cup of tea. There's regular features from Matthew Page and Tony Gosling, continuing on the theme of community. Malcolm Greaves, as ever, the actor, reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. And Trevor Carter, the resident bard, reads his latest poem. And Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for a What Song Guide and the Song of the Week. Well, I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to introduce the first guest, Mr. Tom Stubbs. Hello.
Hello.
So how long has your interest in filmmaking been going on? Where did it start out?
Well, I started making films in 93. What's that? Do the math. 17 years, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. What sort of things did you start out doing?
It was at a foundation course, so it was really sort of primitive stuff, messing around with Super 8 cameras and early sort of computers, trying to just do simple animations.
Yeah.
That was a while ago, though.
Okay, so how was...
I'm delving the depths of my brain to remember, but yes.
Okay, how has your interest in films developed, particularly given the internet and emerging media and all the technology that's changed so drastically?
I mean, it's the interesting thing, I suppose, from a kind of point of view, sort of almost a Marxist point of view, is that the about 10 years ago, there was the invention of DV cameras and PCs that could edit and deal with footage, and you could get a pretty good broadcast standard type of edit from a piece of a kit that was about £1,000. So, in terms of product, you know, there is this sense that people can, for next to nothing, make a film. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that people can make good films. Mm. But
it enables you.
It certainly enables you, and I certainly think that the world I'm in is based on that, probably that simple premise that the actual method of making films has got a lot cheaper.
Okay.
There's a lot of people around in Bristol, in and around Bath that specialise in working.
You and your colleague Steve Clark have formed the basis of Bigger House Films. So what do you and sort of Steve, you know, what is your vision together for Bigger House Films? What do you?
Well, visioning, that's the hard bit. I mean, that's also what I was doing on Sunday, which Anthea turned up to.
Indeed, our producer Anthea Page went to see some films that were being shown at the Pier and Centre.
That was a part of a process that I've been undergoing, which is to actually start. The bit I'm good at is making the films. The bit I'm not, well, reasonably good at, the bit I'm not, or I've learned a bit, like the more you do, the less you actually know. But the bit I'm trying to do now is piece that, these films, and try and find an audience, because I believe there is an audience, because we try and make the films as entertaining and as well as possible.
Okay.
And we try and, the people that we work with, we try and get their real character and their real sort of soi de vivre into the film.
Okay, so describe a little bit, you know, the kind of people that you work with on these films and who you're filming and what was your inspiration for working with them?
Well, it's often sort of a chicken and egg situation in that there are people put together some money to work with people of certain groups. There's lots of funding structures out there that often have ways, you know, you have to work with a group that is this particularly affected, or, you know, box ticking.
Mm.
So, as with a lot of cases, there'll be a client wants to make a film that is specifically aimed at, say, people with learning difficulties and may tackle, like a recent one we did a year ago was the NHS dental health practitioners in Somerset came to us and said, make us a film because there's this group, these young people with learning difficulties who somehow seem to be falling out of the dental catchment. And we thought, okay, how can we make that interesting? Because that, you know, we've got to make a dental hygiene video.
Right.
So we thought the only way to do that, and this is what we try and do with all our films, is to try and turn that the boring subject on its head and we made a dental hygiene animated musical with kids with special needs. So we try and do something that both challenges us because we've never done a musical before, and also something that really interests us and in the end pleases the client, because they didn't quite know what to expect, and then they were very pleased with what came out. And we also had an amazing amount of fun on the way with Bridgewater College, the kids from Bridgewater College on that.
And they do say you shouldn't really work with animals or children, and you seem to have picked all the most difficult sounding people to work with. It must be quite a challenge. How do you cope?
It's just finding the one thing that you need to find and I think that works across the board with anybody, is just a tiny little soupçon of the idea that you want to partake in something together. Mm-hmm. And that's all you need. And then, whereas if you haven't got that, then there's a struggle.
Okay. What are you doing at the moment with Bigger House Films, and where do you see yourself going?
These are questions we do ask ourselves, and we're onward to more interesting and better things. We started Bigger House about 2 or 3 years ago, and it's just snowballed, and the work has kind of, we need to now take a step back from actually doing it and try and get more people in to maybe do the editing and more people to do other things.
Interesting. Well, listeners, take note. Where can people sort of find out more about Bigger House Films? And, you know,
we've got a website which is very badly and needs, but there's lots of films there. So there's lots of films that link through to YouTube.
Excellent.
So biggerhouse.co.uk. Mm-hmm. Lots of animations, lots of different things that we've done. We're also a partner in another company called jumpcuts.co.uk, and that's with a company that's us and Somerset Film, and that's all our learning difficult disabled work is put together in that under Jump Cuts. It's just a banner, really. It's just a name. It's not really a company yet. But there's jumpcuts.org.uk.
Okay. Well, at any rate, your website is biggerhouse.co.uk.
Yes.
And they can check that there. Brilliant.
Okay.
Oh, well, thank you very much for coming, Mr. Stubbs, and best of luck with your future endeavours.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, our next musical interlude is linked to our next interview. So here it is. Here goes.
I like a nice cup of tea in the morning, for to start the day, you see. And at 11:30, well, my idea of heaven is a nice cup of tea. I like a nice cup of tea with my dinner, and a nice cup of tea with my tea. And when it's time for bed, there's a lot to be said for a nice cup of tea.
Cup of tea and a slice, George.
Right, mate, how many lumps?
Three, please.
Blimey, what do you want? The tea in the sugar pot?
This has been well stewed, hasn't it?
Well, what do you expect for 3/8 and champagne?
Now, don't get rude.
All right, mate, don't get narky, but you can't beat a nice cup of tea, can you?
Well, what do you want?
I'd like a nice cup of tea with my dinner. Lovely, isn't it? And a nice cup of tea with my tea, thank you. And then when it's time for bed, there's a lot to be said for a nice cup of tea.
Well, as you might have guessed by the pronunciation of the word community earlier on in my introduction, eagle-eared listeners, my next interview is about tea. I'd like to welcome Katie Williams and Aaron Penman. Hello.
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 Now, you're studying at the University of the West of England.
Yes.
And you're both in your third year.
Yeah, we're both doing graphic design.
How have you found that?
Really good, yeah. It's been quite challenging, but it's really good. Now we're in our third year, we decided to do a big project.
Okay, so how long is it until you've got to sort of hand this all in, like, it's all the pressure's building, I guess.
Less than a month now.
Less than a month.
Yeah. It's D-Day is end of May.
D-Day, end of May, right. So how much is exam and how much is coursework?
Well, you have a sort of visual culture part of it, which is an essay, which is 5,000 words for our final one. That's handed in before Christmas and done. But the majority of design is all work, really. It's all physical work. There's module file work and there's sort of designed outcomes and briefs. So there's not really a great deal of exams.
Okay, so this is your biggie.
Mm.
Right, okay. So tell me a little bit about you know, how you got together to work on this project. You both sort of decided together, you know, you decided to work together and then created this concept of community, is that right?
Yeah, basically we both had our own projects, and then we were both doing kind of little tea parties to kind of get people together, and we decided that we'd make it kind of bigger scale and work with our audience. So we decided to go out and work with the public.
Yeah, so it came to sort of come to Queen Square because I live just over on King Street, and it was a nice sort of area to, we looked at and we thought we need a place where there's a community existing but there's not really a great deal of interaction going on, so we chose Queen Square for that reason, for the potential it had, and also it worked, okay, because so there's not that many things going on. So
tell me a little bit about how this fits into your graphic design project then. So how does the idea fit in with what people are going to see at the end of your project?
Well, we have the design things up to the actual tea party. So there's the advertisement of it, there's the sort of printed side of that.
Yeah.
And then after that, there's something we're going to produce to hand to the audience again, or, you know, and also for our peers at uni. So there'll be some sort of printed material for the end of it to sort of explain what happened and how it happened and and all that. So
tell me about the community project. What is the concept?
Okay. Well, basically, we decided Queen Square because we thought saw it as like a human crossroads. Mm-hmm. How people always kind of go through there through different pathways, but nobody actually stops and kind of talks to people and socialises.
Yeah.
And kind of our theme was to really get people to socialise more, face to face interaction. And I'm doing social networking, and Aaron's doing time and.
Yeah, time. It started out as time and moved along to experience and sort of the common experience. So it was finding common grounds where we can unite people over a common cause. And, well, a tea party was a perfect excuse to get people together. So
brilliant.
That's the main reason that we called it community, because it was a bit of both.
So basically, a cup of tea is the one thing pretty much everybody's likely to have in common, so use that. Okay. Do you have any fascinating facts about tea?
I did, yeah. We have, apart from tourism, tea is the biggest industrial activity in India. And Katie's got another one for you.
96% of tea is drunk daily in the UK and is brewed from tea bags. But I was also going to say that we decided to do the tea party on two different days for a reason. So we did it on the Wednesday because we wanted to get like commuters and people in the area, like the workers of Queen Square and people around the area together. And then we did it on the Saturday, so we get kind of more of the public, really, and kind of it was a little bit more socialised.
Mm. Did that work out? Did you get two pretty much different crowds?
I think we did, really.
Yeah, there was a lot of workers on the Wednesday that came over and sort of questioned it, and then the Saturday was just general bypasses that were in the area, stopping for a sort of spot of lunch in the park.
Okay. So did you pre-advertise a lot? How did that work out? Did people come along going, oh, I saw this leaflet, or did people just sort of happen upon you?
No, yeah, the advertising worked. We got a lot of the offices, people coming down. There were a few that didn't manage to get them because we'd hand them to the porters on the sort of ground floor and he never handed them out.
Oh, okay.
But they were sent down by the bosses. There's one chap that came down and said, my boss has told me to come down and find out what's going on.
Right.
So we explained to him and said, you need to bring all your workers down and to get a free cup of tea. So
yeah, we kind of gave out invites around the area and around Bristol as well.
Yeah.
So we gave out them to shops and restaurants and just so also cafes around the area so they didn't get offended or anything. So, but yeah.
So how big a crowd did you manage to pull in? Well, guys, saw did they come over a sort of protracted period of time? Was it?
Yeah, it was a sort of paced experience. So on the Wednesday, there was a massive group of exchange students that came over with their tutors, but the majority of them sort of came in dribs and drabs throughout the day.
Saturday was definitely our most busiest day, and I think Yorkshire tea was the most popular tea.
Yeah, surprisingly, it wasn't PG Tips or Tetley's.
Not the nation's favourite.
No, right. Okay. So how many types of tea did you have? What sort of?
We had four types of tea.
Right.
Yeah, there was Twinings every day,
mm-hmm.
Yorkshire tea, as we mentioned, PG Tips, Tetley.
Okay, but Yorkshire Gold won the day.
Not Yorkshire Gold, but Yorkshire won the gold.
Yorkshire won the gold, yeah. Okay, so how did the community aspect of it work out? How did these different groups, did they sort of bunch together in their sort of matey groups? Or
we found that there's a few people who actually came, found people that they hadn't seen in each other in ages. Like a lady came along and she was just like, oh, I haven't seen him in ages. She was called Abby, and I think she saw these two guys who she hadn't met, like seen in 2 years. So that was really nice because we kind of thought It's like really working out really nicely.
Yeah.
And then obviously the people who work around the square, they saw other groups of people from the offices and they're, oh, how are you? So they showed that there is a community definitely there.
Yeah.
And it only takes like two students out of their own pocket to get it all sorted and get people together.
Did you have to sort of find any funds for this? How did that work out, doing all the printing and...
Well, we took it in our stride, really. We knew that we'd have to do something for our final year and we'd have to sort of pay out. So we sort of decided that we'd just do it and pay for it ourselves, really. There wasn't really anyone to sort of fund it. We could have got promotions from people, but it would have caused problems with, like, in sort of insurance reasons and promotion for the council, because you need a site licence to do it. So they said that because it's a student-run event, it was fine, but if we'd have done any more promotion or gotten anyone to sell stuff, it would have... Yeah, it would have upped the cost for us to then have it there or at least get something done.
But I think we definitely appreciated it more because the work we put in, we got out, and it was basically an exchange. So we'd be giving out the free tea for everyone else's to have the experience, which we kind of took from it. And
yeah.
Okay. So what sort of mediums are you presenting your, you know, bearing in mind your graphic design, what sort of mediums are you presenting your sort of results or projects in?
Well, I'm probably going to do something with the print-based materials, so something to hand out to people so they can take away, read the information about it, but also have something to keep that they'd want to have up or something to sort of engage them.
What about you, Casey?
If it's not print-based, I'd probably do motion, or I might do both, but we're kind of leaving it open, so we're collecting all the data we've got from the day.
It's like a presentation video of some sort.
Yes.
Okay, and do you have an end-of-year show? Can people go along and sort of see the results and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, we do. The end-of-year show sort of becomes the end of June. There'll be a lot of advertising around, and I think down on the water side by the watershed, there's going to be a shop window with some sort of information about that.
Okay, brilliant. So just, keep your eyes open, folks, for the end-of-year show. That's the University of West of England end-of-year show, and look out for two graphic designers, Aaron and Casey. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank
you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to the studio Mr. Brian Grist. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I introduced you earlier on as here to talk about an old friend and local musician for many years, Mr. John Loader.
Yes.
Who unfortunately has passed away.
Very sadly, a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Okay. So how long did your friendship with him go back?
To 1971, which is when we met, yes.
Yeah.
Which is when he moved into the West Country.
Right. Well, what was it? Was he a musician then at the time?
Yeah, he was. He was in a blues band called The Devil's Kitchen in South London prior to moving here to the West Country. And, he's always been a musician as long as I've known him.
Okay, and a guitarist, I assume.
A guitar player and singer, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, in terms of him being, you know, you've described him as being very important as a community musician, central to sort of part of the Bath and Bristol music community. How might people know of him in recent years in terms of his reputation in Bristol?
Well, in recent years, probably not, because he's spent recent years living in Rotterdam in Holland. But throughout the 70s, 80s and the 90s, he was a resident in Bath and played in Bath and Bristol throughout that period.
Okay.
In a whole range of different bands, which was basically the bedrock of the local music scene for a very, very long time. There were around about 30 different bands all in all, the names of which have long gone.
Okay.
But a great big floating pool of musicians that all congregated, as John did, around the Bath Arts Workshop when that was operating in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, one particular travelling show called Rocky Ricketts and the Jet Pilots of Jive, who had a certain notoriety in the mid-1970s. And they were Bath-based, and that was the first big show that the Natural Theatre Company put on, and so they travelled all over Europe.
Okay, and John, to a certain extent, was a sort of pivotal figure in amongst these sort of floating variety collections.
He started off as just joining in, and being a talented guitar player and decent singer, he was soon in demand. And then when Rocky Ricketts and the Jet Pilots of Jive broke up, all of those musicians involved in that, and there were around about 30 all in all, they all went off into splinter bands and they all swapped bands, etc. And that actually formed the basis of the Bath and Bristol music scene.
Okay. So what was John like as a friend, and what sort of personality did he have? What kind of guy was he?
An extraordinarily modest guy. Very straight, true guy of great integrity, and very, very modest about his own attributes and talents.
As is often the case, possibly, with talented people, not great on the self-publicity then.
Yeah, no, he did virtually nothing to promote himself. I mean, his joy was, his greatest love in his life was music, and he just played to perform. For example, he wasn't very comfortable in a recording studio, which I think sounds like a good cue to listen to him in a recording studio, doesn't it?
Funnily enough, I think that might be right.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Cowboy in the White House.
Yes, this is a song he wrote in 1981 to celebrate Ronald Reagan's electoral victory.
Okay, so
it's a protest song.
Celebrating in inverted commas. Okay.
Yes, very much so.
So this is he, John Loder. John Loder, back from 1981, Cowboy in the White House to celebrate Ronald Reagan, as we say, celebrating inverted commas as such. So tell me a little bit more about him as a community musician. You say, what was sort of community about him?
It's a bit difficult to explain this because we live in different times now, but through what the Bath Arts Workshop did, both in Bath and in Bristol, because they played here a lot, particularly with the Natural Theatre Company, it's very difficult to communicate what that community-based art project was, which was an enormous and important one in the history of the West Country. And that's what he lived for. He loved playing music as a community operation. So therefore, very few except one band in particular were around for a long time because the personnel were always interchanging. And he loved the opportunity to play with other musicians and give everybody a chance, etc., and was one of a number of people who were like that at that time. And it was out of that music scene that groups like Slow Twitch Vibers and most importantly Tears for Fears evolved.
Okay, right. So what do you think of the community? Do you sort of keep up to date with what music is happening these days, and what do you make of the music scene in Bristol now? It's called a very musical city.
What do I do?
No, and what do you perceive of Bristol's...
I think it's very vibrant at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, very vibrant, and it's quite exciting. I'm particularly impressed with the young jazzers.
Okay, that's interesting. What, is the Bath Arts Workshop still going? Is it?
No, it's long gone.
That's long gone, okay.
Yeah, the Natural Theatre Company still operates there.
Okay. Did he have any success, did he ever travel outside the West Country?
The band that we're going to listen to close this off, The Amateurs, which was his pride and joy, they played in Europe and went on a big European tour before they eventually folded.
Okay. Did they get a record deal?
No, as far as we got was the demo we're going to hear.
Okay.
Which was a great demo, which just narrowly missed getting a deal in 1981. And it was a... he's not singing on it. Lindsay is singing on this one. But it's... he described this as the best musical moment of his life. So I think it's a fitting one to play him out with.
And I suppose as a fitting closing question, really, what do you think his greatest legacy is as a musician and as a human being?
The encouragement he gave to others and his great, great passion for music, which he communicated constantly, always. He would never be happy unless he was talking about music, which is a great thing.
Oh, sounds like a man after my own heart, to be honest.
Yeah, well, and if he wasn't talking about it, he was playing it.
Fair enough. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and let's close this with the next track, which is a Springsteen song, I understand, called Rendezvous.
Yeah.
That was a Springsteen song there, played by John Loder, and that was Rendezvous. Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Jenny Savage on a radio project going on in Cardiff.
Jenny Savage.
Can you tell us about your project Star Radio in Cardiff?
Yeah, I did it in 2005, and it was an artist radio project. We just sort of used the idea of the radio to kind of explore the local area through different radio programs that people in the local area made themselves. So they just came in and talked about the things that they were particularly interested in the area, and then we made radio programs based on that and broadcast them back.
So you got a temporary license, didn't you?
Yeah, it was just a week temporary license.
And how many hours did you pack into this temporary radio station?
We recorded about 116 hours of pre-recorded programmes and then also had live programmes on top of that. So we started broadcasting at about 7:30 in the morning and went through till about 12 at night.
How much preparation did this take?
Well, I was working in a shop on the project for 6 months beforehand, but I was working on the project for about a year in total prior to the opening of the shop, so it was quite a long project.
How did you come across the idea to just open a temporary radio station?
I didn't come across it. It was just from, I was cycling each day to my studio through five different areas of Cardiff, and I was just interested in how different each area was, and I was kind of curious to explore what that difference was, and I decided to, because I've been working a lot with sound, decided to make it as sound recordings, and then that just kind of developed into the idea of doing a radio broadcast.
So was it economic differences that made these suburbs different?
No, I don't think so. I think it was cultural, and I don't mean cultural in the sense of particularly diverse cultures, but I think there was like different cultures that grew up around the different geographies, perhaps. And so, for example, students tended to live more in one area. Another area was a lot more older people and kind of generations linked to the kind of industrial history. And then there was another area was more kind of temporary housing or student housing. So it was more, wasn't purely economic, I don't think.
What impact did your radio station have on the locals?
I don't know.
I mean, did they get involved? Did they enjoy it?
Lots of people got involved. And, yeah, about 300 people took part and lots of people listened to it. I don't know that it had a particular impact, but it happened and lots of people took part, so, yeah.
So were you quite sad when the project ended? Did you get a lot out of it?
No, I was very relieved when it ended because it was hard work. It was really intense, and it had only been designed to have, you know, a particular time span. So, you know, I knew it wasn't like I thought, oh God, it's going to finish. I was working up to that process and then, yeah, fully expected it. So,
would you do it again?
No, it was so much work. It would be like, you know, when you have one of those dreams that you're starting school again, you've got to do the whole lot again. I think with those sorts of projects, you can't repeat them because they are so intense. You just, you know, do them for the moment and then move on to the next thing. I don't think you can repeat them, really.
What are you doing currently?
Currently, I'm doing residency in Lancaster at a library there and developing a couple of other projects, one with a theatre director, which will hopefully be a theatre piece, and I'm writing another book as well.
So what's your book about?
It's a kind of documentation of a symposium that I organised called Newtopia, and it's an academic textbook on kind of architectural utopias.
Well, thank you very much for Jenny Savage for agreeing to be interviewed and to the efforts of Anthea Page. It's time for another track now. Let's listen to a local artist, Beth Rowley, and this track is called Oh My Life.
Everything I'll ever do is being displayed.
That's Beth Rowley there. Well, on to Tony Gosling's feature of this week. The combination of housing shortage and financial crisis is a dangerous one. If we are to be able to continue to house the poorer half of society, we may need to start a big council housing project or look at alternative models to house homeless people and for home ownership. One of these is the Housing Co-op, and Bristol has several. One of the most impressive has views into the city centre and right down the Avon Gorge, and it's in Windsor Terrace in Clifton.
I'm Tony Crofts. I'm by profession a journalist and social activist. And it started off when I moved to a village in West Oxfordshire where the rising prices of property were having a narrowing effect on the age, social and economic range of the population. And I happened to own a quarter acre of land in that village. And we set up, three of us set up a charity, a community trust. We actually invented the term community trust for it. And got planning permission to build six dwellings on this piece of land, which belong permanently to the village and which are rented at rents about 40% below market to people on normal working incomes. Because in that part of Oxfordshire, average house price is about 17 times average income. So it isn't just ambulance drivers and nurses, it's also policemen and school teachers who can't afford to live near their work.
But most people don't really think of setting themselves up as a charity and as a housing developer, do they?
Well, it was very clear to me that if the village owned some of its own land and no one was taking profit out of it, that all sorts of things were possible. Where everyone is divided into smaller and smaller nuclear units, all out for themselves, competing and fearing their neighbours, then things go wrong property-wise.
Now, your housing co-op you've got here in Bristol is in Clifton. It's not like most housing co-ops, which tend to be set up in the more run-down areas or cheaper areas. So how did you come to acquire this property and why?
Well, I spent my 20s in Clifton in the 1960s, and it's sort of a romantic memory for me. And also, Clifton, because of the way it was built and designed, it was designed for social life, and people relate socially differently in this environment from other parts of town, from the suburbs, certainly.
So how is it different in Clifton?
Well, you have these gorgeous, beautiful crescents built on the escarpment down to the Avon, each with its own walking terrace for meeting your neighbours, its own communal garden for having fetes and bun fights in. And people tend to talk to their neighbours about the things they're doing to improve their homes, the new paint they discovered and so on and so on.
But don't most of these houses, I mean, this is a five-storey house you've got here, don't most of these houses been divided up into single-floor flats by now?
Well, they were all divided into flats during the war, in fact, and in the 1960s, more and more of them were taken over by single families who may well have sublet bedsits in the house to pay their mortgage, but there's a strong pride of ownership and a surprisingly large number of houses in single family ownership still in this area.
And if houses are like that, with single family ownership, does it mean that you have a different kind of atmosphere around? Do you do anything together as families?
Oh, yes, indeed, and also with your neighbours. I mean, on Guy Fawkes Day, we have a communal bonfire, and every front door is open, everyone's bringing out food and drink to share, and we also go for outings and expeditions together and so on.
So why did you choose the housing co-op model?
Well, we thought, why should the devil have all the good houses? And this was a particularly beautiful house, and I and my wife had, over the years, acquired enough collateral to be able to afford to acquire it. But there's no way that we, just the two of us, could occupy a 16-room, five-storey house. So we decided to set up a housing cooperative to share it, to make a model of how people, by pooling their income and capital, can actually afford to live somewhere really wonderful.
Now, you've got a beautiful view over the Avon Gorge here. Can you talk figures? How much, you know, do people, you know, if you had to pay for the building, and how long is it going to take you to pay it back?
Well, this is a £1 million house, and which is normal in this part of Clifton. I mean, each floor is worth something like £250,000 if you made it into packets and sold it off as a flat. Each member of the co-op is paying something near to a current market rent while we're clearing the mortgage on the house. But how we've arranged it is that when I and my wife have put in all our life savings to the house, and on our investment, the co-op, out of its total rents, will pay us a 3% dividend, which will provide our pension as we get slowly less active, and we've made wills leaving the house to the co-op when we die, because it seemed better for our life savings to produce perpetually affordable housing for 10 people than to be sucked into some profit swamp in the city through buying an annuity.
Well, most people would be very worried about sharing the liability for their housing with several people, as you've done here in the co-op. How can you guarantee that one of those people isn't going to make a mess of things and maybe not pay the rent or run off with their share?
I know we've registered it as an industrial providence society with the FSA, as a society in the interest of the community, and it has a very strong asset lock, so it can never be sold off for speculative gain.
Because I think most people would associate places like this with shared houses that they were maybe in as students, and people don't really want to share their living space, they want their privacy.
Well, all of our members of this co-op are taking an active part in running a co-op. We have a chair, a secretary, a treasurer and so on. We all work together maintaining the garden. We all make decisions about the maintenance of the house. And we all feel that we are being our own landlords and behaving like intelligent landlords.
Well, aren't you living on top of each other, though?
No, we each have our own self-contained accommodation. No one goes into anyone else's territory without knocking or being invited, although we have no internal door locks, so the house is still rated as a single residence, which makes a considerable saving over having separately rated flats.
Okay, and also you're involved in the Community Land Trust movement. Can you just explain why and what it is?
Well, the trust we set up in Oxfordshire is one of the pioneers of the Community Land Trust movement, and it's perfectly clear, if you buy a house these days, the rebuilding cost for insurance purposes is less than half of its market price. The rest is the value of the land, and it's only by taking the land value out and the land being owned on behalf of the community that you can keep housing affordable.
Can you see a future where land in the city is managed more by local people? Because at the moment it's generally private owners or the council that are managing land, and most people have no control over the land that's around them, the shared space.
Well, I'm involved in the Oxfordshire Community Land Trust, which is trying to set up community land trusts throughout that county. And at present the government are talking about flying in a developer to dump 8,000 houses on a piece of greenbelt on the edge of Oxford. We believe that if there were 800 schemes of, say, 10 houses at a time in villages, towns and urban areas, houses that were wanted, needed, designed for and managed by the local community, it would solve the problem and provide the same amount of housing, but in a much more organic and humane way.
But it sounds like you're just really almost on your own doing this, as against these massive developers that build massive thousands of houses at a time, or hundreds of houses at a time, like people like Persimmon Homes and Wimpy's and these kind of people.
It's a bit like sowing bacterial colonies on a petri dish. You put little colonies down and they all expand and they come into a great big covering sheet all over the whole lot. And we're simply building a model of what can be done in the belief that others will also imitate and follow it and create a movement.
Well, that was Tony Cross there talking from his balcony overlooking the gorge in Clifton. And for more on community land trusts and alternative housing, continue listening next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time for the Honeyed Tones of Malcolm Grieve, another edition of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. This is a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Why, I could never live in London. Of course I'm prejudiced. I'm a country man, a hayseed, a farmer, a Wiltshire moonraker, in fact. What then do I know of London? Or of London life? Very little, but sufficient to desire to know no more, and to thank
providence that my lot has been cast in rural surroundings. Still, during the past summer I have had occasion to visit London frequently, and each time I have been only too glad to get home. One day in London, either for business or pleasure, I can enjoy. 2 days I can do with. 3 days I can endure. But that's my limit, and when this is reached, I scuttle for home with a thankful heart. When I'm asked whether I should like to live in London, invariably I reply, without thinking, I should hate it. And if my questioner asks the reason, I say again without thinking, because it's a dirty, stinking, noisy, overcrowded place. Now that I am trying to set down the true reasons for my dislike of town life, I find these thoughtless answers to be correct and sufficient. These 4 adjectives provide the main reasons why our foremost city holds few attractions for me. Take the first 2 of them, dirty and stinking. Isn't the country dirty and stinking, you will ask? Yes, but rural dirt and rural stinks are clean and wholesome compared with those of London, those petrol-scented streets, the fetid stench of hot, hurrying humanity, and overall, the grime. Grime unspeakable. London's grime from which there is no escape. Country mud and the smell of the byre are pleasing things by comparison. Noisy. It's one eternal grinding roar all day long, all night long, above ground and below. Hideous, mechanical monstrosities striving endlessly to get somewhere. Where or why they do not know, neither do their drivers nor their passengers, but they go on and on, round and round, unceasingly. A mechanical maelstrom which the 20th century has wound up and knows not how to stop. Pity the rural dweller who gets caught up in this insane whirligig even for 1 24-hour. For all night long the slaves of London continue their noise in preparation for the morrow's crazy turmoil. They broke all the crockery in London underneath my window the other night. At least that was what it sounded like. Apparently they brought the stuff in carloads and backed it under my window before they smashed it. At intervals I could hear the buzz of an engine, the gnashing of bad-tempered gear changing, and a raucous voice bellowing, "On the other lock!" and similar directions, interspersed with many profanities. At the time, I could have witnessed with great pleasure the owner of that voice stretched upon a medieval rack. But the 4th and last adjective, overcrowded, is the chief reason for my dislike of London. People, people, people everywhere, all rushing about, obsessed with this modern craze for speed, speed at all costs. At one point they descend into the earth, and at another they are spewed up, London's vomit, all panting, rushing, hurrying. Not content with their mechanical aids to speed, the escalators, some run down them. And others, incredible though it seems, run up them. Poor devils, how dull their lives must be, for they can never stop to think. Slaves they are of London life, and as such they are to be pitied. The farm labourer, whom many of these town slaves affect to despise, is not driven in this fashion. The Londoner lives, as they say in the army, by numbers. The rural dweller does the same thing, but judging his own time, and it is to be hoped, thanking his maker for the privilege. This overcrowding of mankind into large cities is hopelessly wrong. Do not think that I dislike my fellows. I do not, but I dislike them in the mass. I enjoy most alcoholic beverages, but I like to take them separately and in moderation and to savour their qualities. I do not like them mixed up and forced down my throat in quantity. Moreover, in the same way that I dislike getting drunk, because I realise that by doing so I lose my sense of judgment, so do I dislike crowds. For all crowds are a little drunk, and communicate their drunken outlook to everyone who joins them, with the result that the bigger the crowd, the more certain it becomes that its drunken outlook will be adopted by it as a whole. Were not the Londoner's outlook distorted by the effect of being one of an enormous crowd, London, as present constituted, could never be. The fact remains that today it is, and I have to visit it at stated intervals. One's duty must be done, but I thank God each time when I get back west of Basingstoke, and I am able to breathe decently once more. Londoners tell me that while my rural surroundings are charming during summer, all I have during the winter is mud and clouds, to which town is infinitely preferable. Well, it has been raining down here for a fortnight, so I will grant you the mud and the clouds. But in addition, I have peace and room and fresh air. Walk up to the top of the downs with me and look around you. You have windswept coiffures in London, but here both soul and body can feel clean and windswept. Here you can breathe. And here you have peace and room in which to think cleanly and sanely. Here you will realise how small you are compared with nature. Here you will realise the futility of your scurrying in the city. And having realised your own unimportance, you will be content in that these beautiful things are here for your comfort. The other day I caught the midnight train and arrived in Salisbury at 2 o'clock in the morning. I walked to an inn nearby, unlocked the yard gate, got out to my car, locked the gate, put the key through the letterbox and set off for home. I drove through a clean, sweet, peaceful world of which I seemed to be the only inhabitant. London's bustle and hideousness faded from my mind, and something inside me seemed to say, "This is right for you. Don't leave it if you can help it." It is fortunate that we do not all think alike, but I know that conclusion to be right for me. I cannot tell you why I know it. I just do know it. There is no way of explaining it by any logical reasoning.
Well, thank you for Malcolm Greaves' reading there, for that excellent reading of Hedge Chewings, and more of that next week. Well, time for local man, Mr. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimble Hill and the Bard of Dalek Radio, no less, to step in and give us a poetical view. All right there, me babber?
Hello, here I am again.
What have you got for us?
This is called Losing the Line.
Okay.
It's and it alludes to recent events in the news.
I see.
The great institutions are losing the line, the Vatican's drenched in the stench of its sin as it turns two blind eyes to its paedophile ring. As society cries out, "Oh, where is our spine?" as the great institutions lose sight of the line. The poor just get poorer and know they can't win, so they blow their last chance on a lottery fling and try to ignore the signs of decline as the great institutions lose sight of the line. The banks, the churches, the centres of power build screens round their deeds to keep the truth in. And who is to blame? Is it your fault or mine that the great institutions lose sight of the line? A favour's a favour, a crime is a crime. We make our distinctions in spite of the slime. We'd like to know more, but haven't the time. Could it be that we're also losing the line? Conspiracy theorists who chew late in the night on the roots of the cause of humanity's plight, though usually left, may sometimes be right in casting their light on the loss of the line. The timelines we've travelled are now ravelled up. There's a common consensus on what is corrupt. And when systems go down, it can be abrupt. And these are the reasons we're losing the line.
Well, never one to shy away from controversy there. The retiring wallflower that is the Bard of Daleks Radio, Mr. Trevor Carter. Thank you very much.
And, thank you, John.
Just to remind everybody, of course, you do have a book published, which you always modestly forget to mention.
It's called Diamonds in the Desert.
Diamonds in the Desert by T.C. Carter.
Available through Waterstones.
Excellent. So go and pick up a copy immediately.
And remember the Lansdowne Cabaret coming up next week?
How could I forget?
The 9th and 10th.
9th and 10th of April.
9th and 10th. Phone me on 966-5514 if you'd like to make a reservation.
Excellent.
Entertainment on all fronts for only £7 at the Lansdowne, the 9th and 10th. Show starts at 8:30.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, here he is. He's looking more like Johnny Cash every week. This time he's got a kind of country and western look going on, very very proper, with a white-collared starched shirt and the waistcoat. Very smart. How are you, Jeff?
I'm all right, thanks.
And what's going on in Bristol this week?
Okay, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 8th of April, Russian Circles will be performing with support from Earthless at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £8.50 in advance. Into Friday, 9th of April, Morton View will be performing with support from Dead Lieutenant at the Croft in Stoopscroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Also on 9th of April, Baraka, who are a five-piece world music group, will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I feature the Bristol-based two-piece punk rock group Haxel. This is the track Disorder Forgot to Come, and it's from the album Older Than Your Dad. That was Haxel with A Disorder Forgot to Come from the album Older Than Your Dad. For more information, you can check out www.myspace.com/HaxelBristol. Into Saturday, 10th of April, The Suspects will be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Also on 10th of April, Doreen will be performing at the Fiddlers in Wheelway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 11th of April, the Scott Hammond Fortet will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. And just a reminder, of course, I predict the Russian Circles gig will be good. And the reason I think I know that is because I've noticed that all the posters advertising the gig have already been stolen as souvenirs. So you won't see it advertised anywhere because they've all been nicked. So stick that in Google and you'll be able to listen to some of their music. I think it's good. Well, that's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show. The time's up already. Studio guests were Brian Gritz, Tom Stubbs from Bigger House Films, and of course, Katie Williams and Aaron Penman from Community. And remember to look out for the UE End of Year Show. You'll probably see it advertised around town quite a lot. Malcolm Greaves read Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, and the poems were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. The poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Darling Radio, of course, and the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. Studio engineering was by Jordy Royden, and the webpage is by Andy Gordon. The producer was Anthony Page, and I'm John Peters Coleman. Take care.